how to cry. And I showed the clouds how to cover.
Blackstone Audiobooks presents A Man Called Cash, the life, love, and faith of an American legend, by Steve Turner.
I met her accidentally in St. Paul, Minnesota, and it tore me up every time I heard her drawl, southern drawl. Then I heard my dream went back downstream, cavorting in Davenport, and I followed you, big river, when you called.
Question. Did you ever have an imaginary friend? Answer. Yes. Sometimes I am two people. Johnny is the nice one. Cash causes all the trouble. They fight. Entry in Tara Cash's personal book, Dad, Share Your Life With Me.
The Man Called Cash. He's a poet, he's a picker, he's a prophet, he's a preacher. He's a pilgrim and a preacher and a problem when he's stoned. He's a walking contradiction, partly truth and partly fiction, taking every wrong direction on his lonely way back home. The Pilgrim, Chapter 33, Kris Kristofferson. Foreword by Kris Kristofferson. Johnny Cash is a true American hero, who rose from a beginning as humble as Abraham Lincoln's to become a friend and an inspiration to prisoners and presidents, respected and beloved the world over for his courage, his integrity, and his genuine love for his fellow man. Like Muhammad Ali, he was bigger than the profession that brought him to the world's attention, and his spirit transcended the boundaries of ordinary artistic stardom. But he was wonderfully, charmingly human. I am told that when Bob Dylan met John, I think it was at the Newport Folk Festival, he circled John, bent slightly forward, and smiling up at him with pure admiration. It's a reaction with which anyone who ever met him can identify. I first saw him in person in June 1965, backstage at the Ryman Auditorium. I was still in uniform. But when Mary John Wilkin introduced us, his electric handshake was the final nail in the coffin of my Army career. John was, and always would be, larger than life, as powerful and unpredictable as lightning, the deep thunder of his voice a perfect match for his craggy, Lincoln-esque features. June, his partner for life, was the beautiful, effervescent youngest daughter of the legendary Carter family. As bright and shining as he was dark and dangerous. And the two of them were head over heels in love and unquestionably the answer to each other's dreams. The wildwood flower may not have tamed the holy terror, but she definitely smoothed the rough edges of the wildest force of nature running loose in the magical world of music at the time, and together they would become a rock-solid sanctuary and source of inspiration, not only for each other and their beloved children, but for the extended family of lost souls and songwriters they took under their wing. The first words John said to me when we were introduced at Columbia Recording Studios, where I was working as a janitor, were, "It's always nice to get a letter from home, isn't it, Chris?" Cowboy Jack Clement had told him of a letter I'd received from my mother disowning me for pursuing a career in a music nobody over the age of 14 ever listens to, and if they did, they wouldn't be anyone we'd want to know. It might have been why he always encouraged me in my songwriting. He carried the lyrics of one of my songs in his wallet. Although it would be years before he ever recorded one of my songs, I continued to pitch him every song I wrote, giving them to June or Luther Perkins so I wouldn't get fired for bothering him. Once he went to bat for me when his producer's assistant tried to get me fired for letting two songwriters into his session. They had cornered him in a hallway and were trying to get him to listen to a whole album of religious songs they wanted him to cut. My boss told me he wasn't going to fire me because he knew I wasn't responsible for letting them in, but he advised me to stay away from the studio where John was recording. So I was hiding in the basement, busying myself with erasing tapes for reuse in demo sessions, when John suddenly appeared and asked how I was doing, as if he always came down to the basement to see how the janitor was doing. I said I was okay, and he asked if I was coming up to the session. I said I was pretty busy, and he said, "Well, I heard you had some trouble, and I just wanted you to know that I'm not going to start the session until you get there." So I went back upstairs with him, watched the session, and tried to ignore the glare coming from the producer's assistant in the control room. Years later, when I was a performer, thanks to John putting me on stage with him at the Newport Folk Festival, against their wishes, I was taking a lot of heat in a country music magazine for work I was doing to protest the U.S. terrorizing of Nicaragua. John wrote a letter defending my patriotism and pointed out that I'd served my country in the army. He did the same thing for Bob Dylan when Bob was criticized in Sing Out for the direction his music was taking. Leave him alone. He knows what he's doing. John was never afraid to jeopardize his own career by defending what he thought was right. Some years later, I was opening for him in Philadelphia and dedicated a song to Mumia Abu-Jamal, who was on death row. Some officials went ballistic, and after I'd left the stage, they sent word that I needed to go back out and apologize. I felt awful because it was John's show I was hurting. John said, "You don't need to apologize for anything you say on my show. I want you to come on stage with me at the end of my set when we're doing the gospel songs and sing Why Me?" Speaking of Why Me, John once told the guys in his band that Jesus wrote a song called Why Me, Chris? John never lost his sense of humor. When June slipped away from us without warning, he was devastated. At the funeral home where people were paying their last respects to her, I was sitting next to John near her casket as people filed by to offer their condolences. One of the mourners spoke with John, then noticed me and proceeded to tell me what a great singer he thought I was. When he left, John leaned over to me and said, "Well, that's one." I will always be grateful to John and June for the kindness they showed to me and my wife and children. He wrote some very funny letters to his namesake, Johnny, and he was always writing them poems and giving them pictures he'd drawn and toys and books. A lot of books. He had a gift for making everyone he was talking to feel like they were the most important person in the world. His last words to me were, "I love you, Chris." I will always love you, John.